Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today we have an empowering hour again. We're going to have a look at the world we live in from a different perspective, and I'm going to ask you to call in throughout the program, giving us your points of view. What do you see, not the problems as being, but the solutions when it comes to understanding COVID? But we're going to hold that till a little later on in the program, because throughout this entire hour, we're going to be joined by a very courageous medical doctor. His name is Peter McCullough. He'll be talking with us from Texas. He's a distinguished internist, cardiologist, epidemiologist. He has a background in many of the different medical sciences. He is both a practicing frontline physician, meaning he's been there in the emergency rooms working with people who've had every kind of medical condition imaginable, but really doing a lot of work, probably at this moment, more than any other scientist and physician in the world, writing articles to be published in peer-reviewed journals. I don't know the current number. The last time I heard, it was more or less 50, but it may be more or less. He'll tell us that. But also, he holds a lot of respect from other mainstream pro-vaccine, pro-establishment physicians and scientists. He has had a blemish-free, non-controversial career. He is now doing something that is unusual for him and the vast majority of physician scientists. He is speaking against the politics and policies and medical flaws and official actions to deal with the COVID pandemic. For many, he was regarded as one of the world's experts on COVID-19. He is also the chief medical advisor for the Truth for Health Foundation, president of a major society, and editor of American editor-in-chief of a peer-reviewed journal, a Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, a senior associate editor of the American Journal of Cardiology, in addition to his being one of the most cited published authors on PubMed, the official repository of what is considered all high-quality science-reviewed articles. You don't get on PubMed unless you've done something that warrants some respect. Since the time the pandemic was declared, Dr. McCullough took a lead in the medical response. He published the first synthesis of sequenced multi-drug treatment for ambulatory patients infected with the SARS-2 virus in the American Journal of Medicine. He has now published, as of today, I believe, 46 peer-reviewed papers on the infections. He's reviewed thousands of reports, and he's published an additional 700 papers and studies. Again, he is one of the most cited scientists in the world. You can also go to his website, AmericaOutloud.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for that wonderful introduction.
I'm going to do a little different introduction because I have been around long enough in the field of health to see a transformation, a radical transformation, and something I've never seen in my career. So let me just, before we get into the whole hour with you on this topic, and I'm going to go through all the major questions that people in the audience have, I just want to give you a brief look back, because when I first got into the field of health and nutrition, which was 1967, there were only a handful of doctors practicing what today we would call complementary medicine. Dr. Theron Randolph, the father of environmental medicine in America, Dr. Marshall Mandel, Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, as just examples. By the early 1970s, there were probably about 35 physicians in the New York tri-state area practicing what you would call, again, complementary medicine. Now, they all had something in common. They were all being attacked. These were all board-certified physicians who graduated, like Carl Humiston, who's still alive at 95, from Harvard Medical School. He was the president of the local medical board in New York, and he lost his license. All these people had their license challenged. Many lost their license. Why? Were they hurting patients using unscientific principles? To the contrary. they had thousands of patients collectively show up at these hearings to say, we were helped because they chose a different approach, whether it was cancer, heart disease, or diabetes. The state medical board said it is irrelevant whether you're helping the patient or you're using current medical established science. For example, in one case in particular, in California, Dr. James Privateer, who went to jail, by the way, he had over 227 patients show up to say they were all helped because of his interventions using existing natural protocols. But he did not use chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery. He helped them after they had that to regain optimal health and build back their immune system. He was found guilty of not using current standards of medical practice. That was the curse of virtually every single doctor, no exceptions in the entire country. By the late 70s, early 80s, I was in communication with more than 2,000 doctors, 99% working quietly, in effect, not wanting to advertise they were helping people using a different approach. They were having success. Some of these were my close personal friends with outstanding credentials, like yourself. Dr. Martin Feldman was number one at Yale, college physicians and surgeons, professor at Mount Sinai, 84 published peer-reviewed studies when he was still in his 20s. He was board certified in neurology and psychiatry, and we were lifetime friends. But quietly, he learned how to treat patients also using natural protocols, and that's what he did his entire career, and he helped a lot of people. Now, why do I say this? Why is this connected to you? Because when I asked these people to go to Washington with me to protest the harassment of therapies that were working and were actually in the Library of Medicine, but were being rejected, and the state medical board's coming down on these people, and the AMA was behind it, they didn't. Only two physicians in all of America joined me, and you can see the photographs in the video of this back in 1972. But because we worked for 10 years, we finally passed the first bill in America to protect the physician and patient working together. And that took the onus of grief off all these doctors. People like yourself and thousands, if not tens of thousands, other doctors at this time would have not appreciated what alternative or complementary medicine could do. They were practicing to the best they could and with the full belief that what they were doing was the best that could be done. In fact, they frequently thought that other doctors, something was wrong with them. They lost their way. Now, at no time could I get more than 2 to 3 of all of the holistic doctors in America, all the complementary doctors, to protest. Now, jump forward. That was simply to give you a historical preview of that. What I see now is something so remarkable, so extraordinary, that we have never seen it in all of American history. And that is, instead of doing what the complementary doctors did, duck and run, hide, get in a closet and stay there and do the practice, you and others are coming forward and saying, I'm here to help the patient. My practice is legitimate. Look at the results. If you're going to criticize me for something I've done wrong. But what I'm doing is right. And there are not just 2 or 3 of you fighting back against Fauci. There are tens of thousands of you fighting back. And that's how I want to introduce this. So you are in a unique position. You are being attacked. You're not being attacked because of a stellar reputation. You're being attacked because you're challenging the establishment and the status quo. Would you first respond with what that means to you and give us your personal experience? The forum is yours.
Well, that was a terrific summary, and thank you. I just reminded myself that Ignaz Semmelweis in 1847 in Hungary, proposed to doctors wash their hands after they deliver babies to try to reduce the rates of endometritis or infection of the uterus after delivery, and how he was castigated. And throughout history, the first doctor who proposed a patient go on the iron lung for polio, he was thrown off medical staff. And even the first doctor who proposed angioplasty in the coronary arteries, he was roundly criticized. The first angioplasty balloon came up for approval with the US FDA. There were prominent academicians that absolutely frowned upon the idea that we can up the artery and improve blood flow in the middle of a heart attack. History is replete with this. So the idea that we could treat COVID-19 to reduce hospitalization and death is just another story in this chapter of skepticism. And skepticism is a natural part of medicine. In fact, patents are awarded based on skepticism. If there's skepticism or teaching away from a concept, that means a new idea is basically potentially valid as a patentable idea. So here we are today with COVID-19, the biggest medical catastrophe that's rolled in, certainly since the Spanish flu. And doctors like myself, about 500 doctors in the United States, took the charge of treating COVID-19 early to reduce the risk of hospitalization and death. We left about 1 million doctors and about 500,000 nurse practitioners and physician assistants on the sidelines. They were either neutral and doing nothing for patients, or in fact, they were detracting. They were telling us we couldn't do it. We couldn't treat patients, that we have to sit back and wait for them to be hospitalized, or we had to sit back and wait for large randomized trials that would take years in coming, and then wait for guidelines that would depend on those trials, which would even be years later. And people in my circles, doctors in my circles, and I have to tell you, it was allopathic doctors, osteopathic doctors, and naturopathic doctors that took charge. And we organized the country with an early treatment response. And now twice we've responded to crush our epidemic curves.
Good for you. Thank you for that overview. We are reaching 2 years since the first announcement of the SARS virus outbreak in Wuhan. What I would like to address is, what do we know with certainty today, both scientifically from the research and based upon actual evidence, either firsthand evidence among those treating COVID infections or who have been infected themselves from the time the pandemic was announced, because the official policies by health officials and international medical institutions such as the World Health Organization have been inconsistent and contradictory, and so often just flat out wrong. I thought we would go through some of them as an outline to further listeners' understanding of what is certain now about what we've experienced versus the dogma that we were told, the rules we were told, you were told to live by and practice by, versus what you have determined in the interim. Because now we had the benefit of hindsight, and we can look to see, was the media, was the medical community, the scientific community, the government correct on some or all or none of the above? So let's do this. First, let's deal with the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. I just had this week Dr. Jessica Rose on the program, and I believe that you co-authored some papers with her and spoke about the high rate of what they are calling breakthrough cases, which seems to me to be a very misleading term. So could you deal with that first, please?
Well, the term, I think the best term, is called vaccine failure. That is, an individual who took the vaccine and they did it voluntarily as part of a large experiment, a large clinical investigation. The consent forms all say that individuals who sign up for this do it under their own free will, and they do it as part of research. That, in fact, they took the vaccines based on the indication. They're indicated to prevent the development of COVID-19. They are not indicated to reduce hospitalization and death. There were no data from the randomized trials back in the fall of 2020 to suggest they reduce hospitalization and death. But the hope was that they would reduce incident cases of COVID-19. In fact, the registrational trials look good on that endpoint. 90% was called vaccine efficacy, but the overall rates were less than 1% in active treatment and placebo group. That meant the absolute risk reductions were less than 1%. And so because of that, Brown from Waterloo, as well as many others, analyzed the absolute risk reductions and were convinced that indeed the COVID-19 vaccines would have no impact on the epidemic curves. And in fact, that's the case. But vaccine failures have been reported to us by the CDC. And so we don't have to leave the CDC website at all to get the vaccine failure data. And I'll bring your attention to an October 2nd, 2021 report. I'm pulling it up now from the CDC. On October 2nd, they had data through August 30th, 2021. The CDC was telling Americans that there were 2,437 deaths that occurred in fully vaccinated individuals. And they have a high bar for fully vaccinated. They have to get shot number one, shot number two on time, wait 2 weeks, and then be declared fully vaccinated. They have hospitalizations, 10,471. So that fraction, and all of these individuals basically get hospitalized, some die, that fraction of deaths is more than a 20% mortality rate. And sadly, 87% of cases who died were aged over 65, and 70% of those hospitalized were over 65. So the CDC is telling us, they don't have the universe of cases, but they are telling us clearly that the vaccines can fail. They tend to fail in the elderly, and then it can relate to death. And now we have data through the first week of August from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So I'll read these to your audience. They come through a project called Project Salus, S-A-L-U-S, the Humetrics data system. They have, at this point in time, January through August 21st, 2021, they have 161,000 breakthrough cases or vaccine failure cases. 33,000 of them were hospitalized, 10,400 were requiring the intensive care unit. And importantly, in this analysis, this is as the Delta variant shaded in, that 60% of those over age 65 hospitalized with COVID-19 in the United States were vaccinated. And it turns out over 65 in general in the population, 80% are vaccinated. And, you know, it doesn't take an epidemiology degree to interpret this, that the vaccines are failing on a large scale.
What are the greatest risk factors that we're not reporting? And our interviews in the last week alone have shown multiple nurses and physicians working in the front lines who say that very few adverse event reports are made because it's just too much to do, too much time, or there's a bias against doing them. And so the actual number of people dying or having serious injury is far more than what the official figures show. And Dr. Rose pointed out this week that she and two colleagues did a paper. It has not been published yet. It was just been, I read some of it to the audience. Her total figures of death in the United States is 204,000. That's a huge difference between what the official reports are and what they're coming up with. And I'm just appalled that this is not a major point of debate or contention, where you have people who say, here are the figures of dead, and then other people say, no, it's not true. Then you have an open and honest discussion and debate to see whose figures are correct. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, what you're getting to is the issue of vaccine safety and death after the vaccines. And, you know, the one thing, I'm looking at the numbers that the CDC tells us. So the CDC tells us through October 1st, 2021, that there have been 16,310 deaths. Now, that includes patients that receive Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, both inside the United States and outside the United States. Some reporting comes from countries outside the United States. And the question is, what's the factor of underreporting? And there's been some effort put into this. In fact, that's part of the CMS whistleblower lawsuit that was filed several months ago that extrapolated from CMS data at that time, that if we were to calculate all the people who got the vaccine and all of them who died in a short period of time after vaccination several months ago, that number would have been 45,000. And the multiplier from the VAERS data to the real number is about 5. So if we look at this today, we potentially are at 45,000. Many have said if the reporting underreporting is more severe than that, the numbers could race up. I tend to doubt that, honestly. I think the numbers the CDC is giving us are accurate. They could be multiplied by a multiplier of some sort, potentially 4 or 5. And the reason why I don't think the number is larger, I just think the outrage would be greater in the United States. People are still very accepting of the vaccines. Employers would have seen more workers be lost from the workforce due to vaccine deaths. So I think the numbers are sufficiently low that many stakeholders can overlook them. But I'd point your listeners to two important analyses, one by Rose in the American Journal of Public Health Policy and Law, and the other one by McLachlan, which was published online, ResearchGate, and that's from Queen's University in London. they found collectively that 50% of the deaths occur within 48 hours of getting the shot, shot one or shot two. And then 80% of deaths occur within a week. They're very tightly related to the vaccine. There are some nursing home studies that have been done in Scandinavia suggest in seniors the potential direct causality to the vaccine may be about 40% causal. But it's clear that in the frail, it's the elderly who are dying after the vaccine. In the frail elderly, the vaccines are too strong. There's probably too much spike protein generated by some individuals who take up the messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA. The spike protein is now known. It wasn't known earlier, but it's now known that is really dangerous to tissues. It circulates in the blood. It damages red blood cells. It causes blood clotting. And the vignettes are would be a senior in a nursing home takes the vaccine, develops fever, chills, nausea, vomiting, low blood pressure, low oxygen saturation, is found dead the next day. That would be the typical vaccine death that would be reported in the vaccine adverse event reporting system. So, the summary is it's undoubtable that we have now reached what's called Hill's tenets of causality, meaning there's a dangerous biologic mechanism of action. So it's biologically plausible vaccines could be lethal. The second point is very tightly temporally related, that it's internally consistent with other reports. In the October 1st listing from the CDC, we have over 250,000 hospitalizations and other serious clinic visits, serious injuries like anaphylaxis. The CDC is telling us 20,789 Americans are permanently disabled. So it's internally consistent with the non-fatal syndromes. It's externally consistent with the yellow card system in the UK, the MHRA system, where the evidence-based consulting group, the lead consulting group to the World Health Organization, has recommended officially to shut down the program as the vaccines are not safe for human use. So we've fulfilled what's called the Bradford Hill tenet of causality. The vaccines indeed are causing death.
We're told by the President of the United States, Anthony Fauci, virtually all of the media, that everyone must take the vaccine. To not take the vaccine, today you're considered not just an undesirable person, but a dangerous person. And therefore, there should be some form of punitive action. We already have a form of vaccine apartheid in here and in Israel and other countries where you're just excluded. You can't go to a restaurant. You can't go to a movie. In many cases, you have to limit yourself to when you go into a store. And in some cases, they've actually had to wear these bracelets, or in Australia, you had to have a app where you could only go so far from your home and only for a certain period of time. Otherwise, you could be arrested. So the question, then the larger question is, on the CDC website right now, everyone is recommended. There are no exceptions to get the vaccine, and hence they are not mentioning any contraindications or exclusion criteria. They are stating that everyone get vaccinated, including pregnant women, women planning to get pregnant, and women breastfeeding. And this, of course, is what the president is preaching almost daily. However, in all of medicine, there are conditions that preclude you from having a standard treatment, even though if that treatment may work for other people and be beneficial and safe, a drug or whatever, there are always contraindications. Could you go through what you know should be a warning, a caveat, that people who have these conditions should weigh the consequences of the vaccine, what it would provide them, what protection, versus what it could do to them, especially with the underlying medical conditions they have?
Let me just state in response to the presidential statements and the statements from NIH and CDC officials, none of those individuals should recommend the vaccine without reviewing safety and efficacy. A doctor would only recommend a treatment after reviewing safety and efficacy. None of those individuals can possibly suggest to America that they should take the vaccine without telling America how many patients have died after the vaccine. Why did they die? Why were they hospitalized? Why did they have urgent care visits? What are the nature of these permanent disabilities? You can see the difficulty here. We, in medicine, we never recommend or not recommend something without reviewing the data. And you and I are reviewing the data today, but this type of discussion really has to come in a press briefing. It should have come in once a month. We should have had a monthly press briefing on differential safety and efficacy. We have three products. There must be a winner, there must be a loser, and one in between. They can't all be the same. So this idea here, just take a shot, any shot. Americans know that doesn't make sense. They know that there must be a difference. Moderna's 100 micrograms of messenger RNA, Pfizer's 30 micrograms of messenger RNA, Johnson & Johnson's a completely separate mechanism, adenoviral DNA particles. So with no review of the data, one cannot make a recommendation. And if one attempts to make a recommendation in the absence of careful review of safety and efficacy, that's what's called malfeasance. If I did that as a doctor, I'd be accused of malpractice. Right? I must recommend information based on the data. So how can people self-navigate? That's really your question. If people are looking at this, if you go back to the registrational trials, which over 2 months of observation, the vaccines look pretty good. So in the November release of top-line data to Americans in 2020, the vaccines look pretty good. Why? Because 60% of those recruited to clinical trials had no medical problems. They were perfectly healthy young to middle-aged adults who were interested in being in a vaccine trial. They broadly excluded those who were COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, pregnant women, women at childbearing potential. Patients with multiple medical problems did not engage in the clinical trials. So if we kept the populations clean, it's conceivably we could have low risks of side effects. But the problem is you get such a clean population, they're not the ones who get COVID, and they're certainly not the ones who hospitalize and die with COVID. But I would use my clinical judgment to say that any individual could end up with a catastrophic outcome because in the CDC is telling us now we have 778,683 safety reports filed as of October 1st. That number is astronomical. That's more than most medium-sized cities in the United States. So anybody could have one of these catastrophic events. And if there is any underlying illness in an organ system, in an organ system that's known to be damaged by the vaccines, the outcome could be worse. So let me give you an example. Let's say an individual has multiple sclerosis or a prior stroke or Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. Well, if there is a neurologic injury, as Rose has shown in her papers, that's one of the organ systems that comes up in the data review, any neurologic injury on top of a neurologic impairment could be a disaster. I can tell you that the CDC is telling us 9,446 cases of Bell's palsy. Bell's palsy is a temporary or oftentimes a permanent paralysis of the face. The eye can't close correctly. The mouth can't close correctly. It leaves permanent problems for the face and certainly facial appearance for a long period of time, if not the rest of their lives. Let's take up another issue, cardiac problems. The CDC is telling us there are 7,806 cases of heart attacks, probably provoked by a blood clot in the coronary arteries. We know the vaccines cause blood clots, and 6,812 cases of myocarditis or pericarditis. The CDC and the FDA tells us the vaccines can cause that. In fact, the FDA has official warnings on Pfizer and Moderna for those outcomes. So you can imagine anybody with any prior heart problem, a heart rhythm problem, a valve problem, a problem of the heart muscles or coronary heart disease, those individuals are set up. If they do develop cardiac injury with the vaccines, they could be left with a permanent problem. That is either permanent heart failure, permanent damage to the heart requiring medications, or cardiac death. So, I would bring those to the fore. Let's take another category, blood disorders. Blood disorders are known to be a problem, and that if there's already a problem with the bone marrow, one could end up with what's called vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura, VITT. It's a new COVID-19 vaccine disease published in the peer-reviewed literature. There are 3,620 cases of this. This arises about 2 weeks after vaccination and can present with a bruising skin rash, bleeding from the gums, going into renal failure and severe anemia requires hospitalization. Let's pick another category. Another category being blood clots. Now, the FDA has an official warning on Johnson & Johnson and then outside the United States on AstraZeneca, other regulatory agencies for blood clots. Where do the blood clots form? They form in the brain of women in the transverse or cavernous venous sinus, where there's low flow of blood there. And these are very difficult areas to treat. They oftentimes lead to permanent neurologic injury, have quite morbid surgeries to try to get the blood clots out. What I'm describing for you is a disaster. There is no good choice for people to make. The messenger RNA vaccines have too much toxicity along these areas of myocarditis and, and thrombosis. Johnson & Johnson has thrombosis in these delicate areas. And additionally, Johnson & Johnson has a neurologic warning for Guillain-Barré syndrome, ascending paralysis. So you can imagine somebody who already has a neurologic problem, already has impaired heart or lung function, to get ascending paralysis, to have them affect them to the point where they can't breathe and they have to go on the mechanical ventilator. So all of this in totality renders us to a conclusion that the vaccines are not generally safe in everyone. Having said that, we've had probably 200 million people in the United States take the vaccines and they've had no problem. And the difficulty is, with no transparency on safety, the average American thinks, listen, I took the vaccine, I didn't have a problem, you should take it too. Well, for the individuals who've been injured or died, they're saying, listen, we can't take the vaccines. We've either lost loved ones, we're scared of the vaccines, or in fact, we've already been injured and we can't take any more of these treatments. We never advance a therapy that injures even a few patients or kills a few patients in order to benefit a large number. We never do that. In fact, the general consensus would be a new drug would be pulled off the market after 50 deaths. And here the CDC is telling us 16,310 deaths.
When I examine the actual parameters of the childhood research, because now they're advocating children as young as 6 months, babies young as 6 months, that don't even have a complete immune system, what is the likelihood now that there was a unanimous decision by the FDA's advisory board to approve the childhood vaccines to children 5 years and older, and still at 5 years, a child's immune system is still developing, and now they're going to go right from there, right in rush it to 6 months. What could possibly go wrong if you're giving the same identical amount of a vaccine to a six-month-old child, baby, as you would a 300-pound man, one who has an immune system that is probably overstressed, may have autoimmune conditions, and a baby that's still developing an immune system, and I don't see any of the science to support how they can justify that? That's the first part of the question. Second is, when I looked at who was excluded from the three major vaccine trials, it was people with cancer, heart disease, arthritis, dementia, Alzheimer's, and emphysema, and diabetes and morbid obesity. Okay, they weren't allowed in the study. Then who's told to take the vaccine after the study's approved, finally, and it's now a product? All those very same people. Now, that makes no sense. You can't say we have a good vaccine here and we proved it is safe and effective. Well, who did you prove it's safe on? People who are very healthy or people who have a lot of illnesses in America? We have a lot of illnesses. We're one of the sickest nations in the world per population. And even our children are sick with adult diabetes and obesity and heart disease and arthritis. So they excluded children in the children's study who had autoimmune conditions. And yet I've spoken with many pediatricians who said that they've never seen this large amount of children with autoimmune conditions in their entire life as a pediatrician. So we've got a lot of sick children. They're excluded, yet they're expected to take the vaccine. I'm sure you see the contradictions here between what we're saying is safe and effective versus everyone having to take it, including people who could have contraindicated effects. And the final thing is, Dr. Rose said that when we were told by the FDA that pregnant women are fine to take it, and she looked at the study, in one citation that she saw that the study statistics were mainly based upon the third trimester with a very few adverse effects for miscarriage. But then when you exclude the third trimester, which most of the time is not where the majority of miscarriages occur, but in the first and second trimester, it was 87%. And she said, my goodness, look at this. So this could cause 87% miscarriages in the first and second trimester, but they were playing the magical game of let's play with the statistics. Could you address these, please?
A principle of clinical trials is that we only include patients once the product is released to the market. We only include those where we have definite efficacy and safety information from randomized trials. So that means specifically the people who should never have received a single dose of the vaccine are pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, those who are COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, and those with positive serologies. It's very likely that those who have already had COVID across all age and comorbidity brackets, that it's those who are having the excess injuries because the body's already been primed with the infection. A recent paper by Bruce Patterson shows that, presented at the Rome Summit in September, shows that with a natural respiratory infection, the S1 component of the spike protein is still recoverable from human monocytes 15 months later. So with the respiratory infection, there must be an incredible distribution of the virus and spike protein in the body and a lot of work for our cells to kind of scavenge and clean it out. You can imagine somebody recovering from COVID who's fully immune, has no opportunity to benefit from the vaccine, then in an ill-advised manner takes the vaccine, has another generation of spike protein, re-expression of the spike protein on the cell surface. The body directs an autoimmune attack against those organs and cells where the vaccine has been distributed. We know the vaccine's in lipid nanoparticles, so it distributes widely into the brain, the heart, other vital organs, the urogenital system, reproductive system. So we are a setup to damage the human body with these agents that have a dangerous mechanism of action. Now bring in pregnancy. Pregnancy is the most vulnerable of all of our medical conditions in terms of using medicines. We always classify a new medicine where we have no information on safety and we think it could be dangerous. We classify that product as product category X. And so I've published a paper with leaders from Canada and elsewhere indicating the COVID-19 vaccines are category X, meaning they should not be used. And on top of that, pregnancy is not a high-risk COVID category. So in a paper by Pinellas and colleagues, the title of the report is In-Hospital Mortality in a Cohort of Hospitalized Pregnant and Non-Pregnant Patients with COVID-19 in the Annals of Internal Medicine, August of 2021, they found a lower risk for pregnant women compared to non-pregnant women for the outcomes in this study. So no one should think here that pregnancy is a high-risk state. It's a low-risk state, and the vast majority of time, no treatment's needed. And if it needed to be treated, it could be treated with hydroxychloroquine, through steroids, aspirin, azithromycin, other drugs. So we can always get pregnant women through the illness with treatment. With the vaccines, by which the FDA and the manufacturers thought was going to be dangerous in pregnant women, in fact, they were excluded from the clinical trials, in an observational study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which you referenced, there was great controversy in what happened in the first trimester, depending on what denominator was used, because obviously women weren't followed for a whole 9 months, so we can't actually know. We look at windows of time. The rates could have been as low as 12%, but could have been as high as 83% for fetal loss. This sparked tremendous debate in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the New England Journal of Medicine was peppered with articles of concern. And then finally, the authors actually published a modification of their conclusions. The original conclusions were no safety signals in pregnancy. That now the conclusions are, we actually don't know if it's safe in pregnancy or not. The talking points that our head of the National Allergy and Immunology Branch of the NIH with that paper said, oh, we don't have any concerns in pregnancy. Well, I can tell you as a practicing doctor who sees patients in consultation who are pregnant, I have grave concerns about taking the COVID-19 vaccine with respect to, does it distribute to the baby? Does it cause birth defects? Does it cause placental abnormalities? Does it cause blood clotting, which we know is going to be dangerous to the mother and to the baby? Does it cause other abnormalities to the genome? Does it change the human genome? Does it affect organs in utero in development? No one knows the answers to these questions. And because of that reason, COVID-19 vaccination in pregnancy is absolutely contraindicated. It should not be done under any circumstances.
Just this past week, the New York Times, in an editorial, suggested the so-called or hypothetical natural immunity, and should people still be vaccinated? The answer was unequivocally yes. Could you better define the science that supports natural immunity as being more valid to protect the person from future events, not just with COVID, but one of the variants? And also, you mentioned the complications that could occur. You can actually create an autoimmune condition if you've had COVID, survived, and now you get vaccinated on top of it. But could you at least address in your research, why is the media and Fauci and no one suggesting if you've been vaccinated, then start to live a healthier lifestyle and do as much preventatively as possible, so whatever you contract in the future, you're more likely to survive it, rather than saying, oh, if you've been vaccinated, if you've caught COVID and you have immunity, it's not really the same as being vaccinated. Take the vaccine on top of it. I believe that this has become a highly politicized issue.
I agree. In a review by Block in the British Medical Journal, she indicated using CDC and U.S. Census data through May of 2021, we already had 120 million Americans who've had COVID-19, with 44% of those age 18 to 49 have already had COVID-19. That's a large block of individuals who would have been excluded from the clinical trials. The FDA, the Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Moderna all agreed that COVID-recovered patients, and even those with positive serologies, could not benefit from the vaccines, that there was only going to be harm, and the ethics committees correctly excluded them from the clinical trials. Now, fast forward, we have six studies showing harm in individuals who ill-advised take the COVID-19 vaccine when they've already had the respiratory illness. We would never do that with mumps or chickenpox or any of the other types of similar infections. Once somebody's had it, the immunity is robust, complete, and durable. And in this week's website listing in the Brownstone Institute is a paper that summarizes 30 supportive papers for natural immunity. There is fundamentally no risk of serious illness once somebody has a well-documented case, even if somebody has missed documenting their case of COVID-19, but they have positive antibodies or a positive T-detect test, they also are in this assured category in terms of freedom from risk. The only thing that leads to confusion is false positive COVID-19 testing. So if someone has had a well-documented case of COVID-19 with the characteristic signs and symptoms of positive PCR antigen test in January, and then they pop up in June with a positive COVID-19 test as they're trying to board a plane, that's not a recurrent infection. That is a false positive PCR test. And so in a paper published by the CDC and the MMWR, they found several hundred cases similar to that in Kentucky. And they made the claim that if one received the COVID-19 vaccine, they would be less likely to test positive in the future if they had been COVID recovered. And I can tell you, I think that is all a manifestation of testing bias. The CDC tells vaccinated people, don't get any more tests. Don't get any more asymptomatic tests. If someone goes in for a gallbladder surgery or a hip surgery or heart catheterization laboratory, hospitals don't test the vaccinated. They only test the unvaccinated. And so what we know here is that there is fundamentally no credible evidence for serious reinfection. Conversely, someone who's had COVID-19 has zero public health threat, zero public health risk. And I think many of the original recommendations were driven out of fear. There was a fear that one could get it over and over and over again. And we're now 20 months into this. If one could get COVID-19 two times, we would have seen hundreds of millions of cases. We would have seen nursing homes get afflicted with massive outbreaks over and over again. And we didn't see that. The virus basically ripped through the nursing homes. People developed herd immunity. They received vaccination and it's done. And so the bottom line is COVID-19 recovered individuals under no circumstances should receive the COVID-19 vaccine. It's only an opportunity for harm and there's no clinical evidence of benefit.
One of the biggest mistakes, I believe, and this is my own personal opinion, in the entire pandemic agenda is starting off with a grossly flawed assumption and calling the assumption pure science. The testing with the PCR as a diagnostic method to determine and chart infection rates, and someone like the New York Times started it, but all the other people's media picked up on it. If you tested positive, you were considered a case. And the clinical understanding of a case is different than just testing positive. But I happen to know Kerry Mullis. He was a friend of mine. And up on the internet is almost a two-hour interview I did with Kerry. And he's very clear. He won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR test. He said it should never be used as an active diagnosis test. It has a lot of good things it can do. And yet everything that we know thus far that's been done by Fauci and the groups using the test has been not based upon science. But think of, would we have the listing of a pandemic if we didn't have all these PCR tests saying that all these people were PCR positive?
I'm a little less critical of the PCR test because we do rely on it for other respiratory pathogens. But I would say that COVID-19 is such a serious illness that we clearly should have taken the route that we did with HIV and have confirmatory testing. With HIV, very quickly in the pandemic, and I remember this because my career spanned the emergence of the HIV epidemic in the United States, that we always relied on confirmatory testing. We get a first level of testing, confirmatory testing. With the respiratory illness, SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19, we can use the PCR, that's fine, but we can confirm it with antigen testing. The Chinese very early on were confirming it with limited sequencing of the nucleocapsid. We could have just emulated what the Chinese were doing. The Chinese quickly figured out what were the false positive cases and what were the true positive cases. Instead, in the United States, we drove PCR testing. And to make matters worse, we knew that once we got above cycling thresholds of 28, we were going to generate false positive tests. The commercial manufacturers ramped up even greater cycle thresholds because the technology enabled it. So Roche, Abbott, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, Quest, LabCorp, you know, they have cycle thresholds up to 45. So they are generating, and they cycle and cycle and cycle looking for a few base pairs. Most of the time, the primers are for the polymerase, and they can, there's polymerases in all kinds of different cells in the nasopharynx, that in fact, they generate false positive tests. So it is known that if someone's asymptomatic, all we're doing is generating false positive tests. In fact, the CDC says no more testing of asymptomatic individuals. The World Health Organization, the CDC still recommends asymmetric testing. So they recommend in certain situations, the vaccinated don't get an asymptomatic test, but the unvaccinated would. And that's flawed because we now know from two good papers, one from the Wisconsin Department of Public Health, first author is Reimer Isma, and the other one from University of California, Davis, first author is Acharian. Both studies show the vaccinated and unvaccinated carry high viral loads of Delta, which is 99% of our strain now, high viral loads, vaccinated and unvaccinated, and the median cycle threshold is 24. So the point is the vaccinated are no less of a threat than the unvaccinated. Anybody developing the emergence of symptoms, vaccinated or unvaccinated, should stay home, should stay away from work or school, and get a test.
Two issues back to back. First, do asymptomatic cases pose this risk that we have been told? And that was one of the justifications for everybody had to quarantine, and still going on in Australia and some other countries, including France. Tell us the truth about how serious of a spreading condition would it be if you're asymptomatic and have no symptoms. Then secondly, and probably one of the most important things we can discuss, is now the move is to vaccinate all children, no exceptions. And when you read the scientific literature, you're asking, where is there scientific public health justification for this? It doesn't exist that I can find. Tell us about, should we be vaccinating the children from your perspective? And is a person who's asymptomatic at the same risk of spreading the virus as someone who is actively sick?
Let's take asymptomatic spread first. Probably the two most important liberating papers from a public health policy perspective were published by Cao and the other one published by Madewell. And you can look up those citations. And I'm talking to the fact checkers now who listen to this. I really want them to amplify these papers. Importantly, they demonstrated that asymptomatic spread was negligible. And in the Cao paper, they kept looking and looking for truly asymptomatic people that really had the virus there based on confirmatory testing, including sequencing. And you know what they found? If someone is truly asymptomatic and the virus is in the nose, they're actually forming immunity to it and they can't spread it anyway. So the point is no one really can spread it until there's an emergence of symptoms. It's very, very important. So nasal congestion, runny nose, cough, fever, general body aches. At that point in time, the person's infectious and should withdraw from school or work and go home. So if we had careful absentee policies for illness, for work and school, and in public transport, we would be much better off than trying to lock down people who don't have the virus. Lockdowns for well people who are asymptomatic doesn't have any role, just like putting masks on people with no symptoms has no role. Now, if an individual is at school or work and they do fall ill, put on a mask, withdraw, get home, isolate, test. And I think that type of common sense approach, which honestly could have been employed from grandmother's advice back in the 50s and 60s, would be far better than all this, the disastrous public health policy and direction that we have. The original models that said 40 to 50% of the virus is spread asymptomatically were simply false. Now let's move on to children and childhood vaccination. We know from the registrational trials, age 12 to 15, by Frank and colleagues, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that the Pfizer vaccine, given at 30 microgram dose, unadjusted to the adult dose, provided no clinical benefit to children. It only reduced 18 cases of the mild sniffles. There were no serious cases of COVID-19 in the children whatsoever. One could have easily let just have them have the virus, viral infection at home for a day or two and go back to school. But conversely, it made the kids sick. 30 to 40% of the kids had severe reactions, had to stay out of school, high fevers as high as 40 degrees. That was just acutely. Now papers have come in. Two important papers, one by Tracy Hogan, colleagues, University of California, Davis, showing in younger individuals, they are more likely to be hospitalized with myocarditis than be hospitalized taking their chances with COVID-19 and developing the respiratory infection. And that doesn't include the possibility of just getting treatment and getting through the illness. So it is a very unfavorable proposition for any child to be given the vaccine. The parents ought to know they're more likely to put their child in the hospital with serious heart damage than help them out with COVID-19. And then the second analysis came in from Kostoff and colleagues looking across age groups, but most acutely in young individuals. One is more likely to die after the COVID-19 vaccine than take their chances with the respiratory illness and fail all measures and die with COVID-19 across all age groups. But that's very acute in the young individuals. Now fast forward, a report today out of Taiwan, any place where there is a low rate of COVID-19 in the world, and Taiwan is one of the countries that uses very good oral and nasal decontamination procedures to protect against COVID-19. What they've demonstrated is in Taiwan now, and this has been released today, that they now have had 865 vaccine deaths, and they've only had 845 COVID-19 respiratory illness deaths. They have one of the lowest death rates per million population, 35 deaths per million population. The point I'm making is the COVID-19 vaccines are causing more damage, disability, and death in low prevalence countries like Taiwan than actually COVID-19 itself.
Another important issue is ivermectin has been attacked, hydroxychloroquine attacked. Any other drug that is in common use that you've been using and others have been using to treat early symptoms in people from the very beginning has been attacked. What is an ideal protocol for medical doctors? We have a lot of doctors and nurses listening right now and pharmacists and dentists and just lay people. What would be a preventative protocol you could suggest, and why so much of the fighting against proven therapies that have saved lives and could save even more lives, but are completely rejected and attacked by Fauci, all the medical institutions, the AMA, et cetera, the medical journals, The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association. Give us your input, please.
I've been on record now for several months. I think probably starting in May when I had an interview on Tucker Carlson's long program for Fox, where I said I thought since the development of the vaccines, and it started basically in about April of 2020, I think there actually has been an organized and intentional suppression of early treatment in order to promote as much fear, suffering, isolation, and hospitalization and death as humanly possible to prepare the population for mass vaccination. I think the two are linked. I think the suppression of early treatment and the hubris and the unbridled efforts to get every single person vaccinated, in fact, injected multiple times now with boosters, I think these two are inextricably linked. I think it's unquestioned in my mind that the two are linked. Anything that's been done to help people get through COVID-19 has been roundly criticized, has been attacked. And I'll bring us back to Taiwan. You may ask, well, why is Taiwan doing so well? In a paper published by Chu and colleagues in the journal Biomedicine, Volume 11, Issue 1, they highlight what are they doing to prevent COVID-19 in Taiwan? Why are they so successful? Well, they have a huge emphasis on oral, nasal, virucidal agents. And you know one of the agents that they use and they feature in this paper? Sodium hypochlorite, regular old household bleach, a few drops of household bleach in water, gargling it, and spitting it out. They use various forms of peroxide or povidone iodine for nasal decontamination. They have a whole table. Table 2 is a listing of all their methods. It is extraordinary what they are doing because it's an infection of the nose and mouth. In the United States, we've been focusing on masks. That doesn't help. Then we've been focusing on hand sanitizer. It's not an infection of the hands. It's an infection of the nose and the mouth. And the Taiwanese are spending time there. Do you know in Finland, they actually have approved by the regulatory agency intranasal antibodies. They can actually do a nasal spray that has antibodies against the virus and protect against it. There is so much innovation with respect to oral nasal decontamination. And I am regretful that we did not promote this earlier. So now in our current treatment recommendations for the Truth for Health Foundation, as an example, we feature povidone iodine, dilute povidone iodine twice a day, gargle and nasal spray, don't swallow, to prevent COVID-19. Post-exposure increased to 4 times a day. With incipient COVID-19 can do every 4 hours. In a randomized trial by Chowdhury and colleagues, this reduced the development of COVID-19 by 75%, was highly effective. After that, in patients who are acutely sick with systemic illness, sure, we treat with monoclonal antibodies, Regeneron. We then, if we do that, we can skip the oral intracellular anti-infectives. In my view, we move on to inhaled budesonide, oral prednisone, oral colchicine, oral aspirin, and then anticoagulants. We get patients through the illness, those are over age 50 with multiple medical problems. If we can't get monoclonal antibodies, we go to our bedrock agents, hydroxychloroquine, supported by over 250 studies, ivermectin, supported by over 60 studies, including all the outpatient randomized trials, positive. We combine with azithromycin or doxycycline, and then we get into the other drugs. It's sequenced multi-drug therapy. Everybody listening to this, over age 50, everybody's probably going to need some treatment at home to get through COVID-19 and avoid hospitalization and death. We have shown in 2 high-quality papers now that these methods can reduce the risk of hospitalization and death by 85%.
Wow. Now, if you realize, put that on a national level, you're talking somewhere around 400,000 to 500,000 lives saved in America and not allowed because of Fauci. That's the weaponization of science. My final question deals with the corruption of science, the monetization of science. Tell us your experience being a scientist and being a frontline physician, both, what you see these corrupting influences be, and how this is changing how medicine should be practiced, public health should be practiced, and science should be practiced.
The listeners should be acutely aware of conflict of interest, past and present. And it's in the wide open now. I'd point them to a recently published book called COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey by Peter and Ginger Bregan. This has over 1,000 citations. It's easily read by lay people. And it lays out who's benefiting from this pandemic. But it's relatively clear there were planned elements to the pandemic. It's relatively clear that there's active conflict of interest in commentary. So let me give you an example. The former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, is on the border of Pfizer. What is his daily activity? He actually comments on the pandemic and vaccination on CNBC. So we cannot have a former FDA chairman who now is financially tied to Pfizer, one of the vaccine manufacturers, giving commentary on who should be vaccinated. That's a conflict of interest. It should be disallowed. It should actually be off the air. It should be off limits. Now, the FDA commissioner who followed him is Stephen Hahn. Stephen Hahn has left to the venture capital firm that funds Moderna. So Stephen Hahn also should not be providing public commentary. If he wants to financially profit from Moderna, that's his own individual right. Now we have Rick Bright, who was in the White House. He was the one that worked to block hydroxychloroquine from Americans. He's joined the Rockefeller Foundation, also tied to being financially benefited by vaccines. So we have enormous conflict of interest right now. Americans should be very wary of commentary. We know that the National Institutes of Health co-owns a patent for the Moderna vaccine, so we can't have any NIH officials commenting on the vaccine, and that includes the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Immunology. It's a conflict of interest. The NIH should be removed from any type of leadership on vaccine development and public implementation. The overall vaccine program needs external, unbiased oversight by experts, multiple experts. Clinical physicians who treat COVID-19, who treat vaccine injuries, statisticians, epidemiologists, human ethicists, and lay people. There should be an external board that has power to shut down the program or modify it based on safety. We should have had safety reports once a month. None of that's happening. So at this point in time, the only thing we can do is go ahead and close the program based on excessive mortality and safety. We already see officials resigning, the two officials at the FDA involved with the BioNTech biologic application approval. That's the Pfizer vaccine in co-development BioNTech. Dr. Gruber has resigned. We've now seen the head of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Francis Collins, he's resigned. More will need to resign as we shut down the program and start to do damage control and do a postmortem on why the vaccine failed so miserably. The largest vaccine initiative in human history has failed greatly. I'm going to have to let that be the last question.
Okay. I thank you very much for being with us. You're a courageous person. And my compliments to all of you, the tens of thousands who are joining together worldwide to push back and saying, no, we're not going to do what you want us to do if it's not in the best interest of the patient and honors real and legitimate science. Dr. Pina McCullough, thank you for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. One last mention, tomorrow at noon will be the final opportunity for anyone who has not seen the last call for tomorrow. And plus, it'll be a long day. Best places to live in America for safety and your rights being honored, and for environmental issues as well. And the Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science will be on, Guy McPherson, and the tree woman, the wise woman of the Canadian Forest, will be on. So we have a long day, lots of information, great film, most award-winning documentary in history you'll be seeing. Go to GaryNall.com. Have a nice day, everyone.